you've seen this diagram that says, you know, if you have some separation distance A, and you had a two-atom system, and you had energy levels, you might have, say, a 2s state and a 1s state. When the separation is large, they would be two well-defined energy levels. But then, as the separation distance gets smaller, you get a diagram that sort of has this lopsided wishbone shape, okay? So that's a diagram, I think it was in Zach's talk for one place, okay? Now, this just says as you get two atoms closer and closer together, the wave function of the electrons in each of the atoms is impacted by the other potential well from the other atom. And so you get these bigger and bigger perturbations on what the wave function is, okay? Now, as you add atoms, when this becomes, you know, if this were to be 10, then I would have 10 of these little energy levels, okay, in each here, okay? And as the distance gets large, at some point when I'm out here, again, I'm sufficiently far from all the other atoms that I, from the point of view of the wave functions of the electron in each atom, it's an isolated atom. But when I get closer, I get this sort of fleet of energy levels. As n goes to infinity, this just becomes a banded structure. Okay, I just get a nearly continuous distribution of energy levels. Okay, so that kind of makes sense that we could get energy bands. But what we really want to do is we want to try to get a little better quantitative understanding of what it is. Okay, so there's a model that actually you can understand from the point of view of the Schrödinger equation. Okay, I'm not going to go into a derivation of it, but the model is called the Kronig Penny model. All right? And so what you can do is you can think of your material as a series of potential wells. Okay? And let's imagine here's the origin. All right? So each one of these is just the square well potential, finite square well potential we talked about before. And let's say that each of these barriers has a width A. And each of these gaps, if you will, has a width B. Okay? So this is potential energy on the y-axis. And the x-axis is x, of course. Okay? So that's kind of the scheme that we have, all right? And we want to understand what the wave function would look like in this particular situation, okay? Well, in the gaps, all right, in each case, there is a component of the wave function that looks like this. And you'll recognize this. Okay. So this is in the gap. So in one of these regions, that's the wave function. Okay? It's the wave function of a free particle. Okay? There's no potential. In the barriers, you get something somewhat different. You get C alpha x plus D E minus alpha x. Okay? Now, this is for the case where E is less than V. Okay? And you get that alpha squared equals 2m v naught minus e over h bar squared. Okay, so this right here is v naught. Okay? Okay? So this is these wave functions in these two different situations should look fairly familiar to you. Okay? Now, Okay, these are just the basic solutions in these things, but we've got a whole array of these, so we would have to superpose things. It gets really complicated. We don't really want to go into that, but what actually comes out from the boundary conditions is you know that at each one of these boundaries, for instance, right here, at x equals a, you have to have continuity of the wave functions, and you have to have continuity of the derivatives, right? So you know that you're going to have to apply boundary conditions to try to figure out what all your constants are, right? And what you end up with is that the boundary conditions lead to the following behavior. You get that alpha squared times b over 2k times the sine of ka plus cosine ka equals cosine of alpha a, right? So you just have to trust that you would get that. Let's not worry about it too much, okay? All right. Now, that's not going to allow us to actually solve for a, for a, b, c, d. We're not going to get that. You see they don't even enter here. But what it does is it provides a relationship between alpha and k. Well, that's important, okay? Because what happens is that this must be between negative 1 and plus 1, okay? This part does not need to be, if it wasn't attached on this equal sign, this part does not need to be confined to plus or minus 1 region, okay? It could be almost anything. You've got this normalization factor here, okay? But this thing has to be between plus or minus 1, okay? What it means is that, and embedded in these alphas and k's are our potential and our energy. So it puts together, what it does is it puts a bound on the types of energies that you can have relative to the potential energy, V naught. Okay? So thematically, hopefully that makes some sense to you. Okay? There's actually a plot that often gets shown. I'm not sure that this will be very useful to you, but it would be a plot of the left side, for instance, of the equation. And it would look like this, say. Okay, and this is negative 1, and this is positive 1. And so this, everything in between here and here is allowed, and everything out. So this region, so this is the energy, okay? Okay? And this axis is what the left side of that equation can be. Okay? So you get these different values. Okay? And so basically this region is not allowed. This region is not allowed. This region is not allowed. This is not allowed. This is not allowed. None of this is allowed. Okay? The only places where I can get valid values are this range, these values, whatever energies gave me the left side of that equation in this range, these are valid energies. Okay? This range, these are valid energies. These are valid. This range here, these are valid. These are not allowed. These are valid. These are not. Okay? And you can keep playing this game. Okay? So you see that I have a band of energies that are okay. These are not okay. These are okay. These are not. These are okay. So you get the sequence of bands. And in Kelly's talk, you saw that you had a sequence of bands for a semiconductor with gaps between them. And that's the origin of that. Yeah, go ahead.
I understand, like, the equation, and it might have to be between negative 1 and 1, but I'm confused then I'm confused on, like, looking at that, why? Like, I don't know, because of the equation, you're like saying that it can't be that.
It's, yeah, so this constraint just comes out of the boundary conditions, right? You get these different, you know, you get these have k's in them, alphas in them, you know. So at some point, you try to do the things that we've done before, use the boundary conditions of continuity here to get equations that constrain the parameters you don't know, okay? So this is a very complicated problem because you got a whole ton of atoms, but an important constraint equation that comes out of that process of using the boundary conditions is this one. Okay, so I can plot this as a function of energy, or E minus V naught, okay, and I would get some behavior, okay, but this puts a limit on that because the vertical coordinate has to be in some range, okay, all right? Does that make sense? Okay. So, and this actually brings us to the again, she showed, and I'll just do it very quickly, there are three types of material. There's a conductor, right? There's a semiconductor, and there's an insulator, right? A conductor has a situation in which okay, so let me actually say something real quick. So atoms have, we can think of these wave functions as having two different situations. One is where there are the valence electrons, and these are bound electrons, okay? And they're held to the atom by some potential. So they don't want to move around. So I'll draw that. So this is E. So energies down here, these are bound electrons. They're in the call. This is the valence band, right? And if I were to make a general drawing, I would get this is energy, and this is exactly the plot that you saw Kelly show. Okay, so you've got bands, and I don't have energies in these ranges. Well, it matters exactly where these gaps lie in relation to the energies that are binding electrons to the atoms of a substance. For conductors, I have a situation where there is a valence band, and then there is something called a conduction band. And this is true of all atoms. A conduction band would be the next energy that would could be associated with those atoms, but would not really be held to the atoms. Okay, it's sufficiently high energy that those electrons really can move around very freely. They're not held to the atoms very well. In a conductor, the energy gap does not separate the valence band from the conduction band. In a conductor, the conduction band is right next to the valence band. So that means that electrons that are bound right here, okay, there's no difference. If you're just inside of the valence band, it doesn't take much energy to get just inside the conduction band and conduct. So if you're a conductor and you're warm, well, it's very easy for you to go from the valence band to the conduction band and just keep moving. It doesn't take much energy at all. It can be a tiny, tiny amount. There's no gap between the valence and conduction band. In an insulator, okay, the conduction band and the valence band are very widely separated. A band gap lands smack between the two, and it's a big gap. Okay? And in a semiconductor, you have the in-between case, where you have, this is your conduction band, this is your valence band, and you get a very small gap here on the order of one electron volt. Might be more, might be, you know, but it's on that order. Okay? Yeah.
Sorry, on the conductor, the first one?
Yes.
The was no gap. I thought it like...
That's right. The gap, there is a gap, but it's not between the conduction band and the valence band.
It's just between like, it's the like, conduction band, yeah, and another part of the conduction band?
Yeah, exactly. So the conduction band refers to electrons that are very high energy that are just barely bound. But it's a band. I mean, it's just, okay? All right? Now, you can take a material that is an insulator. I mean, you can take different materials and you can change the properties of these materials significantly, because if all of a sudden I have, instead of something that keeps going regularly, but all of a sudden I have something with a small, like this, I put some material in here, then all of a sudden I have these two or three atoms that have wide potential wells and they're very close to each other. This is going to really have an impact on how many electrons how electrons can move around. And it will have an impact on this wave function. Okay? Okay, so does that make sense? Okay? Does it make sense? All right. Now, the thing that I will... Okay, so in this particular case... there is almost no way that an electron, even with thermal, with heat, the energy, ambient energy, that an electron is going to get from here to here. It's not going to happen. Okay, you'd have to do something pretty radical to this material to get electrons from here to here. Okay, and it would destroy the material. Okay, here obviously it's easy. Here, you're in a situation, and there is a factor that controls this. It's called the Fermi-Dirac factor. It's a factor that describes fermions. And you don't have to know this. I just write it for completeness. Because you'll see it in the book. But this factor controls the number density of electrons that can get up into this conduction band. And it has an exponential in it. Okay. And what it means is that if I'm able to supply just a little bit of energy to these electrons, okay, I get a big change in the amount of electrons that go here. If I change this band gap's width by a little bit, I will change by a huge amount the properties of the current that can pass. So in terms of semiconductors, we have electrons here, okay? When an electron goes from here into the conduction band and then moves away, okay, then it leaves a region in the valence band that would like to have an electron in it, okay? So, again, you saw this in Kelly's talk. These are the holes, okay? So when an electron gets up and goes this way, you can actually think about that as a positive current going that way. The holes are moving that way when the electrons are moving that way. What I want to do to finish up this whole discussion is I'm going to get to the point where I can describe to you what a diode is, all right? And a diode is one of the basic semiconductor devices that illustrates some of the properties of semiconductor devices, and, it complements some of the stuff that you guys have talked about in your talks. We talked about semiconductors. You have the valence band and the... conduction band. So let's actually talk about that a little bit more. So we can take a semiconductor that has, this is our valence, and this is our conduction band, and they have some separation here, delta E. Okay? So we're just talking about semiconductors now, all right? Now, this may be one electron volt, and because of that scale factor, it'll be pretty rare for an electron to get from the valence band to the conduction band, but it's certainly more than an insulator, okay? But I can actually take this substance, maybe it's silicon, you know, might be something else, and I can take another type of atom, what we called a dopant, okay? And I can mix it in, essentially, so that the wave functions are modified. And that atom might have a different energy level structure that becomes very important. So for instance, just as an example, if you put arsenic, just a tiny trace amount of arsenic in, okay, what happens is you will get energy levels that just correspond to a little bit lower than the conduction band, okay? So let's say the rest of it's silicon. That's got the valence band here. We've got the conduction band here. But now I've got these arsenic atoms every so often in the material, and the arsenic atoms have an energy level that's in the middle of this band gap, okay? And they're closer to the conduction band than they are to the valence band. So what it means is that an electron can get from here to here and then from there to there. Well, even though it's the same delta E, if you go through the exponentials, this could produce a much larger increase in current because I will get just this little difference going from here to here will be a significantly larger probability than going the whole way. And then it'll be instantaneous to go the rest of the little distance. Okay? So by adding a dopant in here, I can then modify by, again, orders of magnitude, the behavior of this substance. Okay? Now I can put materials in that... Yeah. So in the case of arsenic, the arsenic has electrons in this band. Okay? So it doesn't have a gap here. It actually has an electron in this band. So you put it, and all of a sudden, it electrons don't have to go very far at all. Okay? So these energy levels that are very close to the conduction band, these are called donor energy levels. Okay? And this type of a semiconductor is called an N or negative type semiconductor. So these guys have electrons that are very close to the conduction band. Now there's another situation that you can do. You can take the same basic configuration and you've got your conduction band and your valence band. And you could add another material. Do I have an example of it? Yeah. So say indium. So I'll just write it down actually. In the case of arsenic has the following top level valence state: 4s2, 4p3. Okay. Indium has 5s2, 5p1. Okay. Relative to silicon, this has an extra electron. Okay. And relative to silicon, this needs an extra electron. The silicon is a p2. Here, when I put indium in, now what happens is I need an electron, okay, in the indium, but then these levels here are a little bit higher than the valence, okay? The typical valence for silicon. These are called acceptor levels. Acceptor energy levels, okay? So here, I have, I want to get electrons from the valence into these levels and then up. Here, I have electrons. I want to get them up into the conduction band. Okay? Now, here we see electrons moving. Here, because we've got acceptor levels, we tend to talk about holes moving, okay? Because we want to get electrons here. Every time we want to get an electron, we think about it in terms of holes moving, okay? But this is called a P because of that, and holes are positive. This is called a P or positive type semiconductor. Okay? So these are the two main types, And you can do a lot of interesting things with them. So you get N-type semiconductors and P-type. No, if you didn't have that, you would just have this situation. Okay. And actually, I'd have to look into it, but for instance, again in Kelly's talk, in the photodiode case, you're not interested in some of these issues, and you just want to be able to see, well, if I have a gap here, this delta E, if I can get an electron ejected here, okay, then the energy absorbed of an incoming photon is going to be H nu, okay? So if I can get an electron to go up into the conduction band of the semiconductor in the CCD, then this gap is H nu. You got a work function also. It's a photoelectric effect. But if this frequency is a visible frequency, then this camera is sensitive to visible light, okay? So, and this gap actually naturally for something like silicon is about the right size to be sensitive to visible light, okay? So it makes a nice photodetector in that way, okay? All right. So the last piece of this is, all right, now how would we actually build something that would be useful? Well, one of the devices that actually is used quite a bit is called a diode. All right, a diode is a device that will pass current in one direction, but not the other. Okay, and that's a very useful thing. So we've got N-type semiconductor, P-type semiconductors. Can I erase this? Is that okay? All right. In a diode, one simple diode is called a PN junction diode. Okay. The P and the N are referring to P-type semiconductor and N-type semiconductor. And a PN junction diode basically consists of taking a P-type semiconductor and mating it to an N-type. You just butt them up against each other, okay? Now, in the P-type, I have a bunch of acceptor levels. I got a bunch of holes here. In the N-type, I've got a bunch of donor electrons. Okay. Now, the net charge of the P-type is the same as the net charge of the N-type. Okay. And there's no electric field in this. So if I just leave it the way it is, I will get a couple things. First of all, I will get some, because of the way these work, I will get some thermal current, IT, that will go from P-type to N-type. Okay. And I will get some equal current, I'll call it R, recombination current, which will basically take, as soon as I get a couple electrons that go in this direction, now I have an electric field that wants to suck electrons back to the P-type. I sub T and I sub R. This is thermal, this is recombination. Recombination means the electrons, yeah, they traveled away from the atoms, but then they came back. Okay? This situation is called the no bias case. Bias is the way that we refer to there's no voltage on this. There's nothing to bias the currents here, meaning to affect them in an imbalanced way. Okay? So this is the no bias case. Now we can modify this. Okay? So in the no bias case, I'll write it over here. In the no bias case, IT equals IR. Okay? Now, I can take this device and I can put a bias on it. I can put a voltage on it. So I would do that. I've got my voltage source here. I hook the P-type up to one electrode. I hook the N-type up to the other electrode. Okay. Now what happens is that IT stays the same. Okay, so this is called reverse bias. IT is the same as it was before, okay? But now IR, okay, gets to be a little bit bigger, okay? Sorry, that is a little bit reduced. Now, these are both small. These are semiconductors, and without any electric field or anything, these are both small. So what I get is IT and IR are now not equal, okay? IT is a little bit bigger than IR, okay? And IR is in this negative direction, okay? Remember, IR is less than zero, right? So what I get is a small negative current in this situation. Okay, in the reverse bias case. But I don't get much. And if I take this voltage and crank it up, it's not going to change it by much. Okay? All right, and I'm going to diagram what these look like in terms of energy bands, and then we'll be done. But the third case is forward bias. All right, so actually let me do here. So this is reverse. Okay. In the forward case, now I'm going to flip this. Okay. Now what happens is that I'm going to get electrons that really want to go in this direction. Okay, I'm pulling them in that direction. I'm putting a positive charge over here. These electrons really want to go in this direction. Okay? And I thermal stays the same. So IT is the same. IR is large and positive. Okay? I want to get a lot of current now coming through this semiconductor. So what that means is that in the forward case, I get a large positive current. Okay? So let me try to diagram a little bit what the energy levels look like in the hope that that will... In the no bias case, okay, this is the P-type semiconductor. This is the N-type. This is the conduction band up here. This is the valence band. So this is energy or potential, okay? And this is X, okay? In the P-type, I have some acceptor levels here, some holes. Okay? In the N type, I have some donors. Or electrons here. Okay? And in this particular situation, these energy levels are the same. Okay? EA, if you want, acceptor level energies, are the same as the donor level energies. So the electrons just sort of could slosh back and forth. They don't gain anything. They're not going uphill or downhill in terms of energy. Okay? In the reverse bias case, you end up with a different situation. The donors are here, and the acceptors are here. Okay. Well, the electrons want to go towards those holes, but they can't. They got to go uphill. This is energy. This is, okay, energy or potential energy. Right? So they got it. There's a lot of work has to be done to get any of them to get up into those acceptor levels. Okay? So this is the reverse bias case. And again, this is P type, this is N type, this is the conduction, this is the valence. So this is the reverse bias. Okay? And this is no bias. Okay? In the case where I have forward bias, this is the P type, this is the N type, okay? I've got my acceptor levels here, I got my donor levels here. These electrons, they really want to go down to those acceptor levels. Okay. So you really want to have a current. What you've done is you've used the electric field produced by this source to so that this is much higher than this. Okay? You're using the electric field to control the relative level of the energy bands in the two parts of the PN device. Okay? Now, this actually is how an LED works, actually, okay? Because what happens is when this current starts to flow, it could be a large current, it can heat up the device, it can produce light, okay? So that's what an LED is, a light-emitting diode. That's what it stands for. Okay, the last thing I will say about this for rectification, you have a AC source that goes positive and negative current, okay, and you want to go from AC to DC, what you do is you have to somehow flip it or at least just get rid of the negative part of the pulse. And you do this with diodes, okay? If you put an RC circuit on there, then this has a decay constant. So then you get something that looks like this. And it starts to look like a DC source. Okay? The description of all of this, okay, I've given you a thematic description here. When I have no bias, meaning the voltage, I get no current. So if I were to plot, current versus applied voltage. So here is applied voltage, and then this is current. Well, I've said that when I have no bias case, I get no current. Okay? I've said when I have a reverse bias case, which means a negative voltage, I get a small negative current. And it doesn't change much. When I'm in the forward bias case, which is a positive current, a positive voltage, I end up with some large current, okay, which I haven't described quantitatively, okay. The thing that controls this current is that Fermi-Dirac scale factor. Okay? And in particular, the behavior of the current, that Fermi-Dirac factor was just the factor which described the probability to get into the conduction band. But to actually calculate the current, you would have this. This piece here is describing the small negative current you would get over here. And then you have a term here that gives you this exponentially increasing current with positive voltage. Okay? And in a normal PN junction diode, it does. It looks, the behavior looks, is very well predicted by this model.